Supposed Virtues of Business and Freedom. In the words of Thorsten Veblen once again, it is not that these captains of big business are naughty. It is not that they aim to shorten human life or augment human discomfort by contriving an increase of privation among their fellow men. The question is not whether this traffic in privation is humane, but whether it is sound business management. As long as there is no sin in one's behavior, as dictated by the market faith, all resulting outcomes and atrocities can be dismissed, including global poverty, human trafficking, resource overshoot, climate change, sweatshop slavery, water pollution, and other externalities that the market god need not recognize or understand. I would argue, unmetaphorically, that money and markets now serve as the prevailing religious order of the modern world. The free market, with its still upheld religious invocation of the all-seeing and all-knowing invisible hand, is the center of the faith. This idea that one can navigate selfishly and then expect outcomes for the greater good is profoundly mystical. As such, why should money and business, in all of its all-knowing, omnipotent glory, not be the force that drives public policy? At the time of writing, there are many frustrated grassroots campaigns saying, "Get money out of politics." As well-meaning as they are, this is equivalent to, "Get liquid out of soup." We live in a world where everything is for sale, and the act of sale is considered sacrosanct. Life has been commodified, packaged, and made available to the highest bidder. So why should the line be drawn with government when it is virtually drawn nowhere else? Moral illusions. My first real introduction to the business world was a corporate desk job as an entry-level video editor and music composer for a small production company in Midtown Manhattan. Within 2 years, I found myself as a manager, overseeing the work of a small creative team. Everything was fine for a while, but slowly the company started to fall apart. Paychecks started to be delayed here and there, and then they stopped. The bosses promised that the issue was due to pending client payments. We became used to the ebb and flow of inconsistency, working diligently as we were told, with confidence, that everything would work out in the end. Unfortunately, that end proved more and more distant, and eventually the entire staff found itself almost half a year behind in payment. I decided to go to City Hall and look up the company to see if it was going bankrupt. It turned out it was, and if the company kept up appearances long enough, it would not only void its debts, but it wouldn't have to pay the employees either. I certainly needed to move on, but losing the money the company owed me was not an option. I was now in substantial debt, living off credit cards to make ends meet. I thought about small claims court, but if the bankruptcy went through, the company would not be held accountable either way. It was a trying personal experience, not only for myself, but also for the other desperate employees, many of whom had families and children to take care of. Talking to the bosses proved fruitless, as they were not going to level with us given what they had at stake. I think in the back of their minds they were honestly trying their best, seeing the bankruptcy as a proactive stopgap, hoping they would turn the ship around for the sake of everyone. Unfortunately, when the walls start closing in and risk takes hold, ensuring personal survival is often not conducive to social goodwill or honesty. So, growing increasingly desperate, knowing there was value to the data and projects I had on my server, I transferred files I had been working with onto an external hard drive and held them hostage. Upon quitting, I explained I had the files and would not return them until I received the salary owed me. After a week, I was sent a check, and I returned the data. As it turned out, I was the only one who ever received back payment, leaving about a dozen others with aggregate losses of almost $200,000 after being officially laid off. This experience really made me think about not only the market economy's inherent ethical challenges, but also how long one's moral convictions to be respectful and honest can withstand increasing levels of financial stress. The bosses were a married couple, and they had just given birth to a second child a month prior. From their perspective, I suspect the well-being of their employees was secondary to family, as would probably be the case with most people. Was their decision to cover up what was going on unethical? What about my behavior of holding their files for ransom? Was it unethical for me to have held those files and not demand payment for all the employees rather than just myself? In an economic reality where it is expected that some companies will fail as a natural law of competitive market dynamics, how are moral lines and behavior to be drawn when well-being or survival is constantly at risk? To consider such questions, which will be returned to later, let's examine the general history of moral debate. While it's certainly a vast and complex subject, with a range of theories as to the nature of what it means to be right or wrong, most traditional discourse revolves around the duality between moral relativism and moral objectivism. Moral relativism means different people, or different cultures, can hold different moral views of the same situation. For example, a person with the conviction that eating meat is immoral, hence deciding to be a vegetarian, stands in contrast to a person who sees no moral issue with the harvesting of animals for food. Yet the same person who does eat meat might find certain kinds of meat appropriate, while other kinds not so much. For example, a Western meat eater accustomed to the traditional fare, along with a culture of dog domestication, might very well find it repulsive and immoral that in areas of Asia people eat dog. Such is the nature of moral relativism. German anthropologist Franz Boas extended this theory to demonstrate the power of culture itself in determining core values and beliefs of people within it. Boas coined the term cultural relativism, a further distinction expressing the strong influence social tradition has when it comes to what individuals consider appropriate or not. Cultural relativism is obvious from a historical perspective, with a vast spectrum of deemed moral behaviors common to some cultures standing in stark contrast to others. From accepted human sacrifice of the Aztecs, to the polygamy of Mormonism, to the endo-cannibalism of the Yanomami tribe of the Amazon, social variance across time and region is quite fascinating. It is also easy to see how one's acceptance of a given belief, moral or not, can become reinforced simply because it is shared by many in the same culture. Moral objectivism, on the other hand, says moral truths must be universal, that is, they are external to the beliefs of an individual or culture, like a law of nature. This view is where the debate really heats up, since moral relativism is more of an observation than a method for analysis. There is something to be learned from the phenomenon of relativism, such as the power of culture to shape people's beliefs, along with the day-to-day heuristic logic that leads individuals to come to moral conclusions based on their personal experiences. However, most moral concerns gravitate toward an imposition on others. After all, anyone with a true moral conviction generally expects others to conform to that belief as a matter of general integrity. They tend not to just sit by and allow the seemingly immoral behavior of others to go unaddressed, especially if they deem it severe. I have yet to meet a person who holds a strong moral belief who isn't socially active on some level, seeing the need to try to persuade others to share his or her view as a moral obligation. Philosopher of science Michael Ruse argues that humans evolve to think of morality as objective to motivate us to act. If we do not feel the need to act and influence others, it could even be argued that the very purpose of moral conviction, or morality in general, is useless. Yet, moral objectivism as a theory has serious faults. The first is the reality of conflicting moral dilemmas. A man comes to your house and asks if you know where a friend of yours is, saying he is going to kill him. You do know where he is, and you happen to have the moral conviction not to lie. Yet, if you tell the truth, your friend will be in danger. Since you also hold the conviction that murder is wrong, you have a conflict. What do you do? Well, as most would, sacrificing one conviction, truth-telling, to uphold the other, no murder, is the rational compromise. One is simply deemed more important than another, given the context and severity of consequence. The problem with objective moral assumptions is they are isolated or localized, ignoring the systemic nature of causality. Moral logic cannot simply be reduced to singular instances. What may seem like moral behavior in one instance can very well create a systemic chain reaction that leads to highly immoral outcomes. To the extent that negative consequences can be predicted, they become a critical part of the assessment of any decision. In fact, I would go so far as to argue that reductionist morality, meaning moral judgments isolated to a given moment only, can be immoral in and of themselves, since they forego consideration of larger order effects. Another associated problem is the continuum fallacy. A continuum fallacy occurs when two or more different states or distinctions are assumed, while those distinctions actually exist along a fluid continuum of states that cannot be differentiated. A common example would be the debate on abortion. The continuum is human life itself. The general moral view is that murder is wrong. Obviously, we have laws to deter murder in society, even though many societies do allow for murder when it comes to combat, capital punishment, or self-defense. Regardless, on the whole, murder of human beings is generally seen as wrong, and the abortion debate asks, at what stage of pregnancy a fetus is to be protected as a human being? Pro-life moderates may say it is okay to abort a fetus before 6 to 8 weeks, with various explanations as to why. But regardless of these attempts to create a distinction, there is really no defensible starting point for the initiation and development of singular human life other than conception itself. All arguments to draw lines through time principally fail as a continuum fallacy, since how life is to be defined cannot be objectively differentiated once fertilization has started. The human life cycle is a process that starts with conception and ends with death. Is there a way to create differentiation that avoids the continuum fallacy? Yes, but only when external factors are weighed in, bypassing the localized view and moving into a systems view. What are the possible long-term outcomes of having a child based on the social condition? Is the fetus healthy or will it have a severe, painful, lifelong disability? Is the family in a financial position to support the child, ensuring good quality upbringing? Is the region or even society itself equipped to accommodate another human life? These are difficult yet relevant questions. For if it is predictable that a child's birth is to set in motion a life of abuse, deprivation, illness, and suffering, the notion of what is moral then takes on a different tone. It could very well be that the most immoral thing a parent could do is to bring a child into conditions unfavorable for development. If pro-life concerns secure the birth of a child into an unfavorable precondition, and that child grows up as an aberrated adult who kills another human being due to such life distortion, is the initial moral righteousness to save the baby still preserved? Of course, one could turn that around and argue that if the issue is poor development, personal suffering, or a statistical threat to others, why not just kill anyone at any stage with those deemed issues? This argument fails because social factors change when a child is born, along with where the child is in the life cycle. In our basic drive to survive, it is an act of conscious self-interest to see to it that murder and violence are not wholly sanctioned by society, given our most basic social goals of a peaceful and fruitful coexistence and reduced suffering. First, there is the clear destabilization that occurs in societies that constantly fear violence. I am unaware of anyone who prefers a gangland society, where people can be killed at whim for differing beliefs or just for walking down the street. Second, people in society naturally connect with others and become larger than themselves. We are social creatures, and our very existence depends on and is defined by others. This means one's death can be not only emotionally traumatizing for others, even affecting their long-term mental health, but it can also lead to retributive murders, generating destabilizing chain reactions. We strive for rules of tolerance and advocate general peace in communities, not only because we may have a moral conviction, but also because if we didn't, we would personally be at risk, along with social integrity itself. This socially connected experience is not the same for a fetus in utero, since the social bond is almost exclusively between the mother and child. This is why the pro-choice view focuses on the mother, as she is the one who has the most to endure as far as immediate risk is concerned. It is the mother who can suffer direct complications from an abortion or childbirth and is most prone to having long-term trauma, both physically and emotionally, from either event. It is also the mother who, assuming no legally recognized father, is responsible for the child when born. While it is indeed difficult to consider the level of awareness of an unborn child in utero, especially at the later stages of pregnancy, we do know that the unborn have yet to experience social existence in a real way. That can only occur once born, locking in a range of social bonds between mother, father, and other members of the family or tribe. The bottom line here is that there can be no singular right or wrong view of this issue, or, in fact, any issue. Moral assessments can only be made in consideration of context, with extended variables and consequences factored in. Put another way, a systems-based assessment is needed to make the most appropriate judgment for a given circumstance. Now, this is not to say general moral guidelines have no role. The cultural decision to generally value human life and its protection is a viable moral worldview because it translates into increased personal and social security. However, that doesn't make it objective in the sense of being universally applicable without exception. The complexity of life poses far too many circumstantial variations and conflicts in which the violation of general moral principles can be justified. Of course, superficial perceptions of this kind of thinking tend to make people nervous, and with good reason. It could be countered that if everyone freely evaluates a situation to decide on the morally appropriate course of action, people could justify destructive or immoral actions by subjective, biased, or poor rationalizations. A classic example is the greater good claim regarding war crimes by leaders, as noted earlier in this chapter, on cultural superiority. History is full of genocides and murders led by seemingly ethical people, claiming that their actions are morally right in an end justifies the means kind of logic. Still, as problematic as this is, it does not change the fact that judgment is invariably contextual and multidimensional. So, just because an appropriate wrong judgment occurs does not suddenly mean the only solution is the objectivist view. We see this mistake made by religious institutions, codifying moral laws such as the Ten Commandments. It is very easy to simply declare that some singular act should be right or wrong. Social establishments have attempted this for thousands of years with great hypocrisy-ridden failure. The old but still common view that religious moral objectivity is required by society to have any hope of not producing rogue, murderous, raping cannibals has also been a long-standing myth of many faiths. The truth is that moral reasoning is really no different from any other form of intellectual judgment in the interest of truth. As such, the proper context for moral evaluation is epistemological, which simply means there must be some kind of justifying and inferential framework for validating ideas and knowledge. From this epistemological perspective, moral objectivism, as in the nature of religious moral codes, falls under the umbrella of what is termed philosophical foundationalism. Foundationalism is the view that all knowledge ultimately rests on a foundation of non-inferential understandings or pre-justified belief. Non-inferential means that at some point a given idea or statement of fact requires no further justification. It's deemed a fact, and that is that. In other words, it should no longer be questioned. To use a tree metaphor, the firmly rooted trunk is like an unquestioned foundational belief, while the branches are derived beliefs built upon or inferred from the foundational trunk. For example, there is a God, is a foundational statement that, through faith in its truth, requires no further justification. From there, people can inferentially build or justify a host of other beliefs, as is common to theistic religious philosophies. Foundationalism is partly a response to an intellectual phenomenon known as the infinite regress. Infinite regress is considered the central problem in fully understanding anything. It expresses the fact that logically, any proposition or statement of assumed fact requires justification. Yet, all justifications must in turn be justified by something else. This means that any proposition or statement of assumed fact can be endlessly questioned to infinity. A classic example of this regress is in questioning the existence of God. Somebody says, "God created the universe," with the logical thinker next to him chiming in with, "Okay then, who created God?" Aristotle was perplexed by this problem, as it makes trying to understand anything rather unstable. If every cause is also an effect in reason, then how do we find any universal truths? So Aristotle argued that there must be a stopping point where a proposition or belief no longer requires further justification. He vaguely described a kind of innate knowledge related to our built-in sense perception where, like a hierarchy, knowledge is built upon a foundation of these true facts. To date, I have yet to read a really clear treatment on the issue, despite its popularity. René Descartes is famous for saying, "I think, therefore I am," implying that one can at least be sure of one's own existence, hence also arguing there must be some kind of unquestionable foundation to all knowledge. Again, how this pragmatically relates to viable inference and decision-making is never made clear. What seems to be argued by Aristotle appears related to what biologist Edward O. Wilson termed sociobiology, which links our basic biological and perceptual nature to certain propensities as a species. An example of a possible sociobiological link to moral thought could be mirror neurons. As studied in many primate species, these are neurons that fire when one observes an event endured by another, generating an empathic response. This kind of response is physiological, not logical, meaning it occurs in most people as an automatic reaction to observing others' behavior or experiences. An example is a person in great emotional distress. On average, people sense the distress and can become sad themselves. We see this phenomenon in the effect of movies, as the viewer identifies with a character and feels his or her experience even though the character may be fictional. Generally, if there was ever evidence of something of a human nature related to moral sensibilities, mirror neurons seem to be the closest evidence for it. These neurons, apart from also assisting learning, seem to be a means to bond people, creating a sense of connection and compassion. However, as relevant as this phenomenon may be to human society, it doesn't serve our purposes here. The point here is to establish intellectual, defendable reasons for moral conclusions. If the evidence of mirror neurons and sociobiology does hold weight, then empirical observations of the phenomenon can be measured and included in larger order arguments, just like anything else. For now, we will focus on the purely intellectual issues, since there is no clear way at the present time to understand how such sociobiological reactions translate into full defendable moral ideologies. Now, the archenemy of foundationalism is called epistemological coherentism. As with foundationalism, there are many subtle distinctions around this idea, with no shortage of tedious historical debate. For the sake of simplicity, all we really need to understand about coherentism is that for a belief to be justified, it must be consistent, or coherent, with other beliefs. These coherent beliefs generally form a belief system, where each singular belief in the system is supported by all the other beliefs in the system. In stark contrast to foundationalism, there are no absolute foundational or privileged ideas that can go unquestioned. Coherentism rejects this absolutism on the grounds that the infinite regress is not that much of a problem to understanding reality. By inferentially associating belief in linear and non-linear ways, we can realize a kind of averaged equilibrium of truth that serves a functional role. Of course, just because a belief finds coherence with other beliefs doesn't mean anything is actually true. Just as with people voting to reach a consensus about something, social coherence, they could all very well be wrong, regardless of their agreement. So, coherentism is really a probabilistic model of intellectual validation. A classic real-world example is the case of Dr. Ignaz Semmelweis, who in 1847 realized that simply washing his hands was reducing infection-driven deaths of mothers after childbirth. This was well before Louis Pasteur discovered the germ theory of disease. Unfortunately, Semmelweis's findings were rejected by the mainstream medical and scientific community at the time, for they did not fit the prevailing system of belief put forward. It wasn't coherent, even though correct, as many deaths continued for years after as a result. So putting all of this together, it is easy to see how ideas about reality can form based upon a small number of core beliefs, as foundationalism suggests. Yet, it is also easy to understand how those core beliefs can very well be wrong. And if the very foundation of any inferentially derived ideas is wrong, it is safe to assume that so are those inferentially derived ideas. This is why coherentism does not assume any privileged root beliefs, and why its theory rejects such absolutism outright. Rather, it floats the idea of truth, using inference to both consider the structure that supports an idea and compare seemingly disconnected ideas to find validating consistency. Now, why is all of this important? If we look beyond the polarized simplicity of moral relativism and moral objectivism, focusing on epistemological structures common to the assessment of knowledge, we can create an improved model of moral evaluation. Aforementioned problems such as conflicting moral dilemmas or continuums can be better addressed within the framework of epistemology as opposed to elevating human morality to something outside of rational thought. Regardless of our emotional reactions, one's morality is really a belief system like any other intellectual process. As such, epistemological coherentism appears to be the best framework of evaluation, as it is systemic, without the baggage of ideological preconception we find with foundationalism. With this in mind, let's now return to the four questions I posed regarding my experience with the company that stopped paying its employees, as it secretly went bankrupt to avoid all liability. Was the company's decision to cover up what was going on unethical? Well, if the owners had explained to the employees that they had just filed for bankruptcy, and there would be no paychecks for months more or possibly never, destabilization of the office would have been certain. Small business bankruptcy is complex with a range of protections and vulnerabilities at different stages depending on the type. Under some conditions, the employees could have sued for back payment. This would have meant what money the owners did have could have been taken. If they were honestly working to save or transform the company through bankruptcy, it isn't hard to see how they could have morally rationalized their dishonesty in not presenting the truth because they wish to avoid such destabilization, assuming the best interests of the employees in the end. What about my behavior of taking their files and holding them for ransom? While certainly illegal, this action didn't trouble me, given the state of desperation I was in financially, owing back rent and living off credit cards. Effectively mirroring the logic of the owners to file for bankruptcy as a failsafe, knowing it would mean screwing the employees in the end, my self-interest was also in play, coupled with the sense that I had worked hard for the salary owed to me, and that getting that payment was an ethical right. Such is the nature of living in a social system that's foundationally oriented around competition, generating winners and losers. Was it unethical for me to have held those files and not demand payment for all the employees rather than just myself? While common good interest has always been something I feel is morally important in general, there was a good possibility that the large amount of money owed to the whole workforce exceeded what the owners had in total. attempting to use the file ransom tactic to help everyone reduce the possibility of getting anything at all. And finally, and most important, in an economic reality where it is expected that some companies will fail as a natural law of competitive market dynamics, how are moral lines and behavior to be drawn when well-being or survival is constantly at risk? This question illuminates a systems view of market economics, one that creates a coherent framework to better understand not only the other three questions, but the entire sociological condition. While we may look at isolated actions in this world and try to judge their moral integrity one by one, the real moral evaluation occurs on the systems level. Remember, modern society, with its basis in market capitalism, as derived from the root socioeconomic orientation of scarcity, self-interest, and competition, as born out of the Neolithic Revolution, functions like a game, except this competitive game is about survival and well-being. As such, the game takes on a very different dynamic than a game in which there is nothing to lose. Not only does this game pose the threat of loss, but its very architecture actually makes loss and suffering inevitable for a large percentage of players. Given this, society's long-standing moral claims and ethical demands find limited expression in such a condition. If the moral goal of society is to try to create the best condition of public health, happiness, and stability possible for the world's population, seeking to prevent suffering, it must be realized that the structural impositions of our economy actually work against that goal. Contrary to prevailing philosophical mythology, moral behavior isn't just about people's individual nature, their education, parenting, peers, social bonds, personal intentions, or other such factors commonly discussed concerning a person's character. This mythology, that morality is only about individual behavior, ignores the incredible stress-inducing pressure placed upon a civilization that is based upon its members fighting with each other to survive. In such a world, ethical behavior as we traditionally consider it is severely limited in its capacity for expression. It isn't that people aren't capable of more caring, compassionate, helpful, and socially respectful behavior. It is that the socioeconomic system won't support it. In fact, I would argue that the more ethical you are, the more likely you will fail in the game of commerce. The system simply doesn't support real human compassion on the sociological level. It isn't designed to. Free will. Now, a great deal has been covered in this chapter thus far. Before we conclude with what is perhaps the most core and paradoxical of all secular social mythologies, free will, I would like to quickly recontextualize some of what has already been addressed. In this exploration, the structural importance of the Neolithic Revolution has been emphasized. Along with its cultivation of trade, settlement, specialization, property, protectionism, and other characteristics that continue to define modern society. In contrast to the assumptions of social dominance theory, with its conclusion that humans are wired to group-based hierarchy, by nature, once an economic surplus is created, regardless of the social system, the adaptive capacity of humans appears far more flexible. This is not to argue a behaviorist view of human nature, which, in extreme interpretation, views the individual as infinitely malleable by culture. Rather, this is about the highly deterministic role of anthropological effects related to broad shifts in economic conditions. In this, the term root socioeconomic orientation has been coined and defined. This specifically refers to the nature of a society based upon competition, self-interest, and, ultimately, a sociology formed around scarcity, fear, and in-group, out-group bias. While many may counter by pointing out that the animal kingdom generally operates in this same primitive way, and humans should therefore not be expected to be any different, this response misses the fact that most species have no option but survival through force and competition. In contrast, humans are not like any other species when it comes to intelligence, variability, and adaptation. The real problem is that we have blindly accepted as custom a society based upon competition and scarcity, regardless of our vast intellectual ingenuity, and the growing scientific evidence that we could, indeed, live quite differently if proper structural adjustments were made. In other words, we are reacting within a social system we have grown to perpetuate and assume as final, not reacting to some immutable restrictions imposed by the earthly habitat, human nature, or some natural law. It is also important to make clear that the current economic mode of capitalism, while touted as the most productive and free system humanity has ever known, is really a system of social control, like all prior systems post-Neolithic Revolution. Its trademark is socioeconomic inequality, a feature that artificially partitions human well-being and power in favor of a very small minority. The modern manifestation of this is called business, which is the competitive mechanism that sets in motion the inevitable inequality we see, organized in lockstep around government power, diffusing any attempts at meaningful democracy. Government, used as a means to create stability in commerce, since there is no true invisible hand to be found, is also used to secure competitive advantage by a select breed of large business powers. These business powers circumscribe government behavior overall, even though the myth that government exists as an extension of the general public, that is, as the will of the people, persists today. This is why the noted national or tribal mythology has been so critical for social compliance and order. The statues, symbols, language, taboos, and other means of cultural manipulation are constant, since the needed cohesion to stifle any interfering social change depends on it. In this, the use of moral impositions and the idea that the problems of the world exist on the individual level and not the structural level are very powerful in effect. As argued, there is a tendency to be objectivist with our moral views, with overly simplistic slogans such as just say no or do the crime and do the time, etc. Yet, moral decisions cannot really be separated intellectually from overall reasoning and logic. In this, we are faced with a systems-based reorientation, since everything is far more entrenched in causality than has ever been understood before. Science has opened these doors, and each situation presents a new set of variables. Proper decisions are contingent on a range of considerations, not static moral declarations. And the ultimate moral conundrum today is this: how can we expect highly moral or ethical decisions by a population submerged inside a social system that rewards the exact opposite behavior? Market capitalism is simply not conducive to mutual human concern. It is a system based on social warfare, cultivated by its root socioeconomic orientation. Now, with that stated, the final subject of this chapter will extend this primitive moral mythology to the notion of free will. Free will is the most reinforced and consistent ideological assumption in the world today. Not only does it rest on the foundation of the central moral and philosophical belief systems of modern civilization, but it also appears to validate itself at every turn in society's architecture and institutions. Every human action is generally assumed to be a conscious, willful, free decision by both others and ourselves. It is a powerful intuition we all share. Our minds are simply wired this way. Yet, once a systems perspective is taken, accounting for statistical research showing the effects of larger order environmental and social conditions, and coupled with modern understandings in cognitive neuroscience, the mythology of free will quickly begins to unravel. Returning to the subject of preconditions from Chapter 1, it is easy to notice the power of regional culture in determining the language we learn as a child, the religion we are taught, or the customs we embrace. it is less easy to notice how people can develop predictable, long-term behavioral propensities as a result of childhood experiences. It has taken advanced scientific study to identify our bioevolutionary requirements, whereby certain things generally need to happen in child development to ensure long-term mental and emotional well-being, while certain things should not happen for the same reason. Our biology has been pre-programmed by evolution to respond in certain ways to stimulus and stress, with predictable outcomes when certain experiences happen. As one's life progresses, the biopsychosocial synergies of life dramatically shape one's thoughts, beliefs, impulses, and actions. This shaping makes certain propensities highly probable, with others highly improbable, regardless of the free will of the person. Drug addiction, as noted by neurologists and pharmacologists, is a kind of hijacking of the brain that subconsciously leads a person's behavior toward the reward of use. The addict is often fully disgusted by his or her actions, but the addiction pattern continues as changes to brain chemistry drive changes to both thoughts and behavior, justifying the next use of the drug. One may indeed overcome an addiction by choice, willpower, and likely external help, but that single end does not discount the general loss of control found during the addiction period. Likewise, analysis that takes a biosocial view of the issue finds great evidence that child abuse, stress, and emotional loss can contribute to one's development of addiction as a form of self-medication. In fact, an entire range of health and behavioral issues can arise later in life, since childhood abuse literally changes and damages the brain. Not only can abuse disturb the brain's neurochemistry, but it can also shrink and distort critical areas, such as the hippocampus. This can lead to severe impairments in one's ability to make decisions and judgments. In the same way, a person who has severe brain damage from head trauma in a car accident may no longer be able to speak. Do we judge a person's speech impairment in such a case as a problem of free will? No, we understand the impairment. In 1966, Charles Whitman, an American with no prior history of mental instability, suddenly murdered his mother and wife. He then proceeded to the University of Texas, climbed inside a tower, and killed 14 others with a gun before taking his own life. In his suicide note, he talked about his feeling of going insane and not understanding his thoughts, and he even requested an autopsy. While the public stood in horror at this monster mass murderer, doctors discovered that he had a brain tumor pushing against his amygdala in the prefrontal cortex. This was, without a doubt, a major factor in his violent acts. While this is a rare case, it raises the question of where along the continuum of body-mind influence we can draw the line and conclude that a person is 100% responsible for his or her behavior. In modern culture, most people draw very clear lines between decisions they feel are free and decisions they feel are not, often with unrelenting judgment and criticism of others who act in ways deemed unsavory. This moral high ground is ever present, which makes perfect sociological sense because, once again, mainstream society flaunts the ideas of independence, free will, volition, and human choice as the starting point of all personal success and human virtue. There is a term in social psychology called the fundamental attribution error. This is an error of judgment people make when they experience a person's behavior as unethical without knowing about other factors involved. A simple example is a man who dines at a restaurant and, upon paying the check, exits without leaving a customary tip. From the standpoint of the waitstaff, that person could be judged as inconsiderate. After the employees share a cathartic verbal bashing of the seemingly rude person, the man then re-enters and puts down a tip. When asked about leaving, the man explains he had no more money on him and needed to get some out of his car. This idea of mistaking a person's apparent behavior as being entirely representative of his or her character can be extended to one's life experience in biology. In a sense, the entire criminal justice system is predicated upon expressing the fundamental attribution error as a formalized method of evaluation. This is not to argue that all human actions can always be clearly traced to delineated preconditions, nor is it to absolve anyone of wrongdoing by default. It is to point out that the general dismissal of such considerations in legal practice, focusing on the fragmented actions of the single person. I would even argue that to exclude the biosocial condition of a person is really a crime in and of itself when one attempts to evaluate someone's actions. The myth of free will makes it easy, while helping to preserve the legal system's role as a means of social control once again. The same goes for the economy, which has clear coherence with the legal view. If you happen to believe that every human being has absolute freedom in thought and decision-making, with no biological or environmental preconditions that can influence behavior to make it uncontrollable, then you would conclude that any action taken is a person's moral responsibility entirely. Similarly, if you also happen to believe the common capitalist myth that economic prosperity is available to everyone who works hard, disregarding any structural elements that may create insurmountable social immobility, then you will likely agree that everyone who becomes wealthy or poor simply deserves what they get. It also isn't difficult to see how such root assumptions can then form a basis to infer more extended beliefs. For example, from the "you get what you work for" dogma, one could reason support for more right-wing or conservative politics, also leading to support for more free trade or neoliberal policies. This could also mean finding little rational motivation for, say, increasing state-funded social welfare to help the poor. Likewise, if market virtue rests on free democratic exchange and the maximization of utility for the greater good, then any intervention by government can only be sacrilegious. To throw one more coherent validation into the mix, if social dominance theory is assumed to be true, then the inequality and poverty in the world can really only be natural and even necessary to some degree to ensure the larger order stability of society. Such shared social characteristics derived from this free will foundation are enormous in modern culture. In the realm of philosophy, the assumption of human choice is a bedrock of discussion, since philosophy is just as much about principles of proper behavior as it is about the investigation of knowledge and reality. Perhaps the most dominant moral philosophy today is utilitarianism. This is the view that the correct moral choice in any given situation is the one that produces the greatest utility, usefulness, in terms of generating happiness and reducing suffering. It is basically hedonistic, viewing the individual as interested in maximizing his or her own utility, benefit, at all times, while at the same time trying to maximize utility for the largest number of people, making them happy too. Sounds great, right? While poetically viable, the way this theory has unfolded in the context of market economics has deviated quite far from its original intentions. Basic economic utilitarianism says that all market behavior is to be reduced to rational, strategic attempts to maximize gain and avoid loss. This reasoning occurs in the purchase of a consumable good, the hiring of labor, or the process of capital investment. It is basically a form of game theory. In a way, it is the theory of how humans behave and how they ought to behave in the context of rational economic decisions. In this process of rational self-maximization, as per the ideal of Adam Smith's Invisible Hand, the greater good is said to be achieved. While much could be said on the issue, what this theory effectively does is reduce human beings to mere gaming agents, shifting focus away from the actual nature of economic production and of real life and societal interaction. The theory focuses only on the abstraction of trade itself. In a way, it creates a false view of equality among everyone in the economy, reducing people to hedonistic exchangers. As such, it distracts attention from structural and imbalance problems, justifying the market's basis in competition and narrow self-interest. One important idea found within this school of utilitarianism is that of voluntarism. Quite popular in modern libertarian circles, voluntarism is about action based solely on free will without any force. In market behavior, the act of voluntary trade is considered the ultimate moral priority. So, a woman has a ring. She goes into a pawn shop and sells it. From this perspective, the exchange is considered to be mutually beneficial to both parties, since the woman willfully sold the ring and the shop willfully bought it. This simple idea of exchange is held up by microeconomic theorists to argue that a trade always serves the best interests of both parties, and even does so equally, since they are both just exchangers, maximizing their utility or personal benefit. The problem with this view is that it ignores all other pressures that distort the will of the individual making the trade. From a voluntary utilitarianism perspective, it doesn't matter why the trade occurs, as long as it appears both parties are acting on free will in the exchange. But what if the ring being pawned was her dead husband's, who had recently been in a fatal accident, leaving his family with no income or means? In distress, with bills to pay and no social safety net, the wife sees no alternative but to sell off a highly sentimental personal item. Can we still call it voluntary? In abstraction, yes. But in reality, that circumstance cannot be dismissed as simply voluntary, just as we can't view as simply voluntary the choice of an impoverished, drug-addicted, and mentally handicapped prostitute to exchange sex for more drugs. Life is a sea of complex, coercive pressures and external forces occurring both consciously and subconsciously. The snapshot of voluntary exchange is a dangerous free will illusion as it distorts social perception of causality, limiting more thorough understandings. At the same time, we are faced with the question of rationality itself. While we are naturally unaware of choices and factors outside of our education or experience, making those choices or factors unavailable for consideration, we also have common inhibitions that interfere with the information we do have. These are referred to as cognitive biases. Cognitive biases are errors and gravitations in thinking and judgment, usually tied to our social condition. Being the social organisms we are, arguably defined by others and culture itself in terms of personal identity and self-worth, the power of our social nature often gets the best of us. A notable theoretical framework to understand this is called social identity theory. In short, people have a propensity to identify with groups, drawing their identity and sense of status from them in many ways. It is observed that people often view their own group as in, with other perceived groups as out, as is characteristic of racism and other forms of group-based bigotry. Consequently, this ubiquitous social tendency for inclusion and approval creates serious psychological problems when it comes to rational choice and critical thought. One such problem is the tendency toward social conformity, or the bandwagon effect. A herd mentality often arises, such that people gravitate toward being consistent with other groups' actions or beliefs, suspending critical thought. One famous study conducted in the 1950s entailed asking a group of people to make simple decisions about visual images, such as which line on a screen was the longest of a set. However, all but one test subject was in on the study. These other participants were fakes, planted to purposely agree on the wrong answer and encourage the test subject to go along with their group decision about the correct match. The controlled study proved a strong effect of peer pressure, with more than 75% of the participants in the total of 12 repeated tests conforming at least once. This is in contrast to the control group, no pressure to conform, where less than 1% conformed. It is not difficult to imagine how this same effect can occur in groups with shared values, such as political parties. People also seem to prefer being on the winning majority side of a given situation, bypassing true critical thought. Bandwagon persuasion is everywhere in the world today and can rightfully be deemed a natural gravitation of our evolutionary psychology. From advertising slogans declaring, "Millions of satisfied customers can't be wrong," to the self-fulfilling prophecy of stock market bubbles in which rising prices driven by buyers simply encourage more buyers in a euphoric trend. Political persuasion is also similar. The media need do little more than present the idea that a candidate, concept, or policy already enjoys popular approval, and the herd will usually follow blindly. There is also the tendency of group bias in general. This means the propensity to favor your group, in-group, while disfavoring others, out-group. This is most common when the groups have some relationship to each other, such as rival baseball teams, religions, or nations. The development of prejudice is predictable, with the history of bigotry largely a group-based phenomenon. An informal yet famous study on this phenomenon was done by an elementary school teacher named Jane Elliott, who divided her third-grade class into two groups based on whether the children had blue or brown eyes. She then explained to the kids that those with blue eyes were naturally smarter than those with brown eyes. Amazingly, this simple act rapidly created group tension and conflict, including name-calling, shaming, and discrimination against the brown-eyed kids. Now, I wish to clarify that this is not about absolute determinism. It is about a general propensity linked to our evolutionary psychology for humans to gravitate toward group identification and to develop biases based upon that identification. As Charles McKay wrote in his famous text, Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, "Men, it has been well said, think in herds. It will be seen that they go mad in herds, while they only recover their senses slowly and one by one." Our social nature being what it is, this tendency clearly does not favor critical evaluation of information. It takes a great deal of self-awareness to notice the propensity when it is occurring. As for causality, our nervous system seems to reflexively want to remain part of a group identity, falling victim to the power of its social influence. Neurobiologist and researcher Vasily Klucharev writes that the deviation of individual opinion from the group behavior, opinions, is interpreted by the nervous system as behavioral error or reward prediction error, which starts the process of behavior change based on the dopaminergic mechanism of reinforcement learning. In other words, our very brains are somewhat trapped between rational thinking and impulsive counter-reactions that seek to prefer in-group conclusions. These lower brain reactions make us vulnerable to numerous thoughtless behaviors triggered by brain chemistry and make us susceptible to external manipulation. The arenas of marketing and politics are perhaps where the greatest damage is done today. In general advertising, for example, much work has been executed in the field of subliminal effects that create unconscious bias. This has even led to making the practice called subliminal advertising illegal in most countries. However, more recent research has shown that the influence of general advertising has a similar subconscious effect. In a 2010 article published by the journal Science, psychologists Custers and Arts report how the unconscious will has a powerful role in decision-making without our being aware. Custers and Arts write that people should be much more scared of commercials they can see rather than those they can't see, for the effect of things like psychological positive reward cues can create bias. Using an example of a soda commercial, Custers and Arts write, "If you are exposed to these advertisements over and over again, it does create an association in your mind, and your unconscious is more likely to suddenly decide you want a Coke." It isn't enough to simply be critical when watching a commercial. The ad can affect your subconscious even when you think it has no power. It does this simply by repetition and by the, usually, positive emotions associated with the product. The only way to avoid the possible influence is to completely avoid the ad. This understanding also brings up a powerful question of ethics. For if people are exposed to repeated ads promoting unhealthy behavior, their unconscious will may influence them, leading to sickness. In this sense, we can rightfully view advertising as a possible form of violence. Now, to conclude this chapter, I wish to clarify my basic position on free will. Taking determinism to its extreme, we could see all human behavior as involuntary, a biological clockwork affecting every thought and cell, driving every event, shaping all aspects of reality with its massive singular motion. Such an extreme perspective accomplishes little. It is much more productive to view the individual and his or her surroundings as a dynamic synergy of cause and effect. As the evidence shows, due to biological, social, and other factors, one's capacity to make choices is inhibited, sometimes profoundly, at every moment of existence. Grasping this gives us a more comprehensive understanding of not only human behavior, but of reality itself. After all, to view yourself and others as partly self-propelled and partly vulnerable to biological and cultural influences forces a very different sense of how and why the world is the way it is. It is also important to point out that no matter what the truth may be in terms of exactly how much free will we have, to believe we are in control is very important to our psychology. Research has shown that people who believe they have control over their lives are much happier and more motivated, which makes perfect sense. After all, who wants to feel like one has no control over anything he or she is doing? Yet, the cold reality is that on a certain level, we are not free and we are not rational. There is a surprising kind of automaticity to our existence, meaning we are doing many complex things automatically. In this, we are faced with a very uncomfortable sense of self and identity. We have to admit that on a certain level, we are simply out of control. We are not in full control of our thoughts and behaviors, and neither are the people around us. Yet, in recognizing this, we are then able to better understand human limitations and weaknesses, allowing for more intelligent decisions on how to better adjust our society to improve human well-being, public health, and social relations. This view, once again, rests on a system-based context of our existence. While having some purpose in supporting our required sense of identity and sanity, the highly propagated, dogmatic, and institutionalized idea of free will and morality is also what keeps us from better understanding the causal factors paralyzing the world, perpetuating the same destructive patterns in public health, civil injustice, and environmental destruction. We are constantly judging people and their individual actions rather than factoring in the structural roles, cultural pressures, modulating stressors, incentivizing influences, dominance mechanisms of control, human vulnerability to submission, cognitive biases, and the litany of other system-based factors that keep the vicious cycles of human disorder in motion. When this higher view is taken, one that positions the individual in a network of factors, bypassing the illusion of singular will and autonomy, a more holistic and effective sense of problem-solving emerges. As such, social activism must become a social science in and of itself. The synergetic, biopsychosocial nature of the human condition needs to be not only understood, but also used as a strategy for instigating needed social change. We also need a firm grasp of history and its effects, knowing that our society's root socioeconomic orientation, as derived from the geographical determinism of the post-Neolithic revolution, has evolved a condition based upon factors of competition, dominance, and scarcity. These factors have been fully absorbed into virtually every aspect of our lives, from the social system to its institutions to the prevailing psychology of the masses. Without these foundational understandings, very little progress can be expected in the realm of human justice and equality as we move further into the 21st century. The negative forces preserving the status quo today are not substantially affected by street protest, public outcry, media exposure of corruption, or other traditional methods. It is fruitless for us to demand idealized or more just behaviors from our existing institutions, since they have been built around a value and incentive system that thrives on the very behaviors we wish to change. Only deep system changes will prove to have long-standing effects, as will be argued in future chapters. Chapter 3. Structural Bigotry, the Economics of Oppression. Where justice is denied, where poverty is enforced, where ignorance prevails, and where any one class is made to feel that society is an organized conspiracy to oppress, rob, and degrade them, neither persons nor property will be safe. Frederick Douglass. After high school, I moved to New York City to attend a music conservatory in pursuit of a degree in classical percussion performance. As passionate as I was about music, the financial reality of my student loans quickly polluted the circumstances. Combined with a growing disillusionment with having to monetize an art form I considered sacred, a tool for meditation and personal growth, I ended my college career at the age of 20 after a mere 2 years. Amazingly, the interest-bearing loan schedule for this short time projected values of over $40,000, a shocking sum for a young adult just entering the earn-a-living reality. Of course, watching my friends graduate with master's degrees from prestigious institutions such as the Juilliard School, only to moonlight in coffee shops thereafter as they struggled with low-paying gigs, wasn't very encouraging either. While I was disappointed at the time, the prudence of the decision is as clear to me today as it was then. As expressed in the previous chapter, economic deregulation and privatization are considered sacrosanct requirements of a supposedly free world. Ironically, the freedom of markets means effectively nothing should ever be free, and being $40,000 in debt certainly didn't give me a sense of liberation. I suspect I have not been alone in that feeling. As of 2015, American student loan debt was about $1.2 trillion, surpassing the GDP of Australia, New Zealand, and Ireland combined. One may rightfully wonder why a society that ostensibly seeks to educate and prepare young people to be intelligent problem solvers and creators would perpetuate a system that shackles them with immobilizing debt the moment they enter the post-education workforce. One may also wonder why many other countries that subsidize higher education through strategic taxation, making sure young people are not inhibited by financial limitation or debt, consistently outperform the United States in global test comparisons. Yet this is only curious if one is unaware of the dominant socioeconomic philosophy of the United States, along with its position as a global empire. Today, the U.S. leads the world in terms of both economic influence and military force, endlessly pushing the neoliberal values of free trade as a root priority. Like a philosophical crusade, it has been deemed an imperative of Western business political leaders to ensure that people comply with what is in effect the new global religion. A religion that invariably prioritizes commerce over everything else, with human rights increasingly subordinated to business rights. When one understands how